Hello and welcome to Dice Punks, your bi-weekly tabletop role-playing broadcast where we think independent works of interactive yarn spinning and tail stringing are just the berries. This week we're putting on a show. Pipe that! Open those ears for No Nyarlathotep. Hello and welcome. I'm Drew, the most rip-snorting game master around this block or any, and joining me are...
I'm Adam, a financier of caliber and seriousness.
I'm Dez, and I will be playing Eugene Lazenby, who's really in this play just for the technical blocking.
I am Nick, and I will be playing Jimothy Slankett. A fresh-faced newcomer to the scene. He's discovered that there's a wide world out there and he wants every piece of it. And if it terrifies him a little bit, well, hey, that's just the price of admission. And in the meantime, he's discovered this little kind of a cult thingy-ma-bobber. There's some eldritch lore that he wants to get a hold of. And God has a few more tentacles than he was taught in Catholic school. But hey, that's them's the breaks.
I guess I should have said that my financier is named McCord Sudweeks, but that would not have helped you take him more seriously, so probably not a net loss. So I'm just a player this time around, but I wanted to let our listeners know what this episode's deal is. We're recording this just before Halloween, when circumstances beyond our control have prevented us from our intended recording of the fourth part of Dez's Unknown Army miniseries. Rather than letting the evening pass without recording anything, Drew, Dez, Nick, and I have selected a one-page RPG from the available, as of this recording, Games for Gaza bundle on itch.io. It's called No Nyarlathotep. It's a lasers and feelings-based game with the conceit of the King in Yellow being staged as a 1930s musical in Boston. In the mechanics, every character has a mark, and they'll try to roll at or above it if they're taking an action that has razzle-dazzle, or under it, if their action is more meat and potatoes. Every character's role, major want, and available help will add or take away dice from their roles, with more successes helping to do a better job and get more information. That's the short version, and we'll explain more as we go. For now, as our resident 30s musicals knower about her, Drew has volunteered to do the GMing, so I'll pass it over to him to explain the rest.
Thank you. As the man said, the year is 1931 and the place is Boston, Massachusetts. We're at the B.F. Keefe Theater, which is a vaudeville house, but folks, we're not putting on a vaudeville or a burlesque, no, no. This is something altogether higher brow than that, but more appealing to the bums and the darbs alike. This here's the avant-garde, as the French say. This here's a book musical. The King in Yellow. The thrills of the Paris Follies, the laughs of a Chaplin or Keaton picture, the music of the Spheres, all rolled into a package that they'll hear from here to Hoboken to Raleigh. It's 6 hours to open a night, and the show's a real dog's dinner, to be frank, but these kids just know they'll pull it off. That's showbiz. So, 6 hours to opening. What is each of you doing? Let's begin, as the theater always does, with the money man, McCord.
Well, I am having nothing else to occupy my prodigious attentions back at the office. I've come down to the theater to personally make sure that everything goes exactly according to plan. Of course, I have to trust everyone as to what the plan is, not knowing very much about all of this stagecraft and actors' art. It all seems like a lot of posturing and bunkum to me, but it's money-making posturing and bunkum, and more importantly, everyone else at the dinner party last weekend had a musical they were producing, so I need to have one too, and this is going to be mine. So it has to be perfect. At least perfect as far as I can tell, which, so far so good, I think.
What you'd be seeing right now if you were looking directly at the stage was a full complement of chorus girls dressed as Keystone Cops, trying to find their light, and failing.
I'm sure that's normal. I hope it's normal.
I am yelling at them from offstage.
Well, and why exactly are you doing that? And what effect do you hope to have? Tell me, what's going on, Eugene? Mr. Lazenby.
So What they don't understand is that they're acting out sigils on the stage. They're dancing their way through the patterns that need to be right. They're off. Two of them are off 2 degrees to the right. One of them is 10 seconds behind the others, and one of them is just turned entirely around, and none of this is acceptable.
The one who's turned all the way around would be Dorothy DeMille, who came highly recommended. She's an experienced taurine, and this is definitely frustrating to you. She is fully off in her own world. She's not turning back around.
I let her know that if she doesn't go in the proper direction at the proper time, then we're going to be giving the part to her understudy tonight.
She responds as quickly as you've ever seen a human respond. Her attention is rapt. Her feet are perfect.
I thank her for her attention and effort now that they've arrived.
They go through it again. They get closer to sigils, but the sigils are not yet perfect. We'll come back to you. So, Jimothy, where are you? You're...
Yes, Jimothy is backstage, looking in the mirror, going, Cthulhu Fatagon, Cthulhu Fatagon, Cthulhu, Cthulhu, for that. And he is, he suddenly kind of starts, he looks in the mirror in horror, and there is just the merest blemish that has begun on his fresh face. And he's like, no, 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 this is my big break. And he furiously reaches for the concealer, you know, to obscure the evidence of this defilement upon his young, fresh face. And he is going over his lines.
To your horror, a veteran actor in the company has seen all of this. It says, face not feeling so fresh there, fresh face?
yes. Well, you know, just the typical pre-production jitters. I'm sure that everybody gets them, right?
Yes, we all do early in our careers.
Jimmy, I don't want to trouble you, but any advice for my big debut?
Well, of course. An actor, you may have heard, prepares. I remember my first acting teacher, Javen Pulfisher. He said to me, Pendrum Bringhurst, they'll know the name Pendrum Bringhurst from here to Timbuktu, but only if you prepare. So always prepare. He looks at you as though this is about the most profound thing anyone has ever said and makes deep eye contact.
Jimothy holds it for as long as he can, but meanwhile, there's nothing behind his eyes because inside his monologue is going, did I prepare enough? Should I have prepared? Should I have prepared for not having prepared? That is the ultimate preparation. Yes. The oh, shit.
He taps your shoulder and says, the jitters go away later in our careers for those of us who are fortunate enough to have a later career, and walks away.
Under his breath as he walks away, Jimothy says only to himself, if things go right tonight, the jitters are just the beginning.
I would like to have moved into this area just kind of like a little ways behind Jimothy at this point, and hearing that go, well, surely there aren't any jitters. You're a talented young chap who we hired not to have jitters. You don't have jitters, do you?
No, sir. No, indeedy. I left those at home, and tonight is going to go swimmingly. You just don't worry your pretty face about that. Did I just say that? I meant, don't worry about it, sir. We're on it.
Small, hard to see in the dim light blush as I adjust my top hat and straighten my back. Well, see to it then that, yes, carry on.
Pendrum reappears briefly. He has forgotten his hat. He takes it and says, ah, left the jitters at home, but kept the splanket.
Jimothy seeks out the choreographer, walking away.
As you leave, you overhear me go, why are there so many buckets back here?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I stepped on that line. I'm glad we got it in. You find the choreographer.
I'm threatening to paint out a route for the dancers to follow from the buckets backstage.
One of them, you're not actually sure which one, says, if you're not happy with the way we're doing it, then do it yourself.
I mean, at that point, it would save us a great deal of money, ma'am.
A great deal? Anybody here getting a great deal? I didn't get offered a great deal. My deal was mediocre at best.
In the aggregate.
They look at each other. The aggregate is pretty tired of running this number.
Then the aggregate had better fucking get it right.
The orchestra kicks into gear and they try to get it right. They get very close. In fact, you're pretty sure you see something glow at their feet. You would know better than they whether this is the particular glow they're looking for, but something's happening.
Progress. From the top, ladies.
Having followed the dancers out, milling as I am, trying to look as though I'm overseeing things and understanding what I'm looking at, I will walk up next to Eugene and say with great confidence, excellent, excellent special effects. That'll really catch the attention. I take it that everything will be correct by the time we start.
If they want to get paid, then yes.
Well, certainly, certainly. I'm happy to pay for good work, but I'm known only to pay for good work. Yes, that's the
of
way.
Of course.
Jimothy, at some point during this exchange, you've arrived. At some point during this exchange, Jimothy has arrived. Whether he's made his presence known or whether he's standing awkwardly is, of course, entirely up to him.
Yeah, I think that he arrives, just kind of sidles up next to the choreographer, assuming that maybe he's noticed, but also trying not to be noticed, and just, you know, just, he says under his breath with profundity, yes, well, Mr. Lazenby, as you know, all the greats know, preparation is the path to success.
Yeah, of course, kiddo. You got your lines down? We worked on them some.
Yep, I think that I've got my lines. Plus, was I supposed to have memorized everyone else's lines too? Because I went ahead and did that.
That's fine. Mostly worry about the lines that are before your lines, so you know when to say your lines.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
You can forget all the others.
Mouthing just along to everybody else's lines the whole time.
I'm going to rule that you're actually doing the choreography that the ladies on stage are trying to do with your, just a little bit, if you looked carefully at feet and hands.
Yeah, there's like a little kind of twitch of the hip.
If you want, you can demonstrate.
I wouldn't want to embarrass the poor ladies.
They do that enough to themselves.
I heard that. That
was good.
That was Dorothy.
You seem only to work when you're properly motivated, Dorothy.
Well, I want to see the kid do it.
All right. I would like to attempt this choreography.
All right. Roll razzle dazzle.
Going to clap you entirely too hard on the shoulders. My full confidence in our young star, maybe overstating it, but you know, meteor at least.
So to Mr. Lazenby, just before I step out into center stage, I say, now, is it 5, 6, 7, 8, or is it something a little less Euclidean?
It starts off 5, 6, 7, 8, but after 3 measures, it drops into 23.
All right, excellent. Now, I'll try to give this the proper pathos. I am open to notes.
Just footwork and hand place. The mudras are important.
Okay, so
I wonder why the dancers are having so much trouble.
It's very simple.
Are they professionals or aren't they?
Can't make reference to certain actors and certain dancers because they aren't on the silver screen yet.
Mm. You've received visions, actually, so you can. No one will understand them, but you're welcome to make references.
So I think that it would be fair to assume that this is a difficult role and that I do have help, perhaps, through the choreographer and his advice.
I'm giving you thumbs up, so I'm helping.
yes, helping.
I'm going to rule you have help, so add that die. Okay. This does engage your want as well. Okay. Mm-hmm. And your role is relevant. So I'm going to say roll 4D, 6. Okay.
There we go. Rolling. Oh,
and what's your mark?
My mark is 3.
His mark is 3.
Okay.
And this is the Razzle Dazzle, so I'm trying to roll high.
Yeah, you're keeping everything 3 or above.
Okay, I have 2 successes then. I've got a 3 and a 5.
A 3 and a 5. All right. So you do succeed, first of all. Mm-hmm. But also you get to ask a question of me, of this place, of the universe. You get to know something.
What is the place that I need to be on the stage, or the movements that I need to do to call the favor or attention of the elder gods upon myself? Because that's something that in my naivete I very much want.
Just a couple of marks stage right of where the ladies have been doing their routine. You see a faint glow and then a less faint glow. It isn't a color you could name. Is it a color at all? What are colors? Best not to get distracted. Suddenly you know that that's where you need to execute the moves and that something will happen if you can hold that time signature right there.
Okay. And then clarification, am I kind of intuiting that this is something that I can or should, or, well, not should, but is it something that I can do now, or is this more for the performance itself as the ladies are doing their dance number? This is how I center myself in the ritual.
You know that something will happen if you do it, whether you want to do that now to impress the choreographer, the financier, the ladies and gentlemen present, or whether you want to do it on the night, that's entirely up to you. Whether I absolutely will not answer.
I would like to do so.
The answer is read the book, obviously.
All right. You get up, you dance. At first, the Koreans are looking on or not looking on with a sort of a disdain, and then more and more of their gazes fall to you. You go into the trickiest of time signatures with grace. You nail it. You nail change after change, and your feet glow. And then the stage glows. The spot operator, who hasn't had the spot on you, because after all, you're in the wrong place, follows you. But that light is drowned out by a light coming from under you. Eugene, you might notice this is not one of the sigils you expected to put on the stage. This is a weirder sigil. It's one you've never seen before. It's one that the moment you see it, some part of you wishes you could unsee. But of course, you cannot.
I am clapping out of time and pretending like this is all to plan, because I know it is.
You are very impressed by the special effects. You also hear a strange muttering in a language that you can't place. You assume this too is, of course, standard.
I probably assume it's like some stagehand, you know, from parts abroad just behind me somewhere.
You assume it's German. Yeah. For all you know, it might be.
I certainly wouldn't be able to tell German from Italian, although I would never admit to that aloud.
The chorus girls are duly impressed. It's up to Eugene whether he's impressed.
I'm impressed. I'm a bit concerned, but I'm impressed.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So you nailed it, kid. You come to a stop. There's a brief tap section at the end. You nail that as well, and with each tap, a word in this unknowable language resonates. Questions will be taken at the end of time. No, I'm sorry. What's going on, Adam?
What's the time signature of the tap routine at the end?
It's in 96.3.
Good, good.
You have never rehearsed this number without at least one of the string players snapping a string, a bow, or a string player. This is no exception. You hear a sort of a snap and a groan from the pit, but nailed it.
All right. Chest heaving with exertion, eyes out into the audience, into the limelight. He comes to a stop and, looks around without trying to look like he's looking around for approval.
You hear a slow clap. Your eyes struggle to focus through the spotlight. Perhaps you put a hand up to see a little better. And there, applauding slowly, is Pedram Bringhurst. Your hero. You've impressed him.
The Pedram Bringhurst?
Who moments ago may have doubted you. He believes in you now. He also, however, seems to have tentacles where his ears used to be.
It's a hazard of professional
theater. He doesn't seem to know it until the tentacles too start applauding. Since that's right in front of his face, he does sort of notice. He then runs screaming from the auditorium. But more importantly, he thought your dance was great.
There's a warm place in my heart as though something is incubating.
Lean over to Eugene. Wasn't that one of our actors? Is he going to be all right? Is the screaming, that's part of the play, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, good, good. Yes, of course. I nod and then move at on any to time, bother somebody Drew, else.
At any time, Drew, that the bullshitting of the money man requires a role, please let me know. Otherwise, I will just assume that it goes off.
I'm starting off very willing to believe that things are going right. It's going to take a minute before I start to get skeptical of that.
I was going to say, if this was a role, it'd be a trivial one. Yeah. Because, oh boy, does he want to believe. There will, I'm sure, come a time when it gets harder. So rehearsal is definitely going better, except for the recently ententacled elder actor who has run screaming from the theater. No one seems too concerned. Dortha says, that guy and his vocal exercises. And already some of the more ambitious Koreans are trying to do the dance the way Jimothy did. And already you're seeing results. They seem to be dancing the sigils a little bit more effectively. They sort of start crowding the area of the stage you were occupying. Do you step aside and let them?
Yeah. No, I'm not going to get in the way of mathematically incorrect art. No, we're in a math that is beyond truth values and moral values.
Yeah, we're actors, we know.
This is internal monologue, I suppose. Or at least I'm trying to keep it internal. That
if you didn't say it out loud, then let's say that was your father talking. somewhere deep inside. But also, Jimothy, do you step aside with grace?
Yeah. Yes, Jimothy steps aside, satisfied that he's got a first helping of whatever that is. So surely he's favored in their eyes, and there was more to come.
You are definitely favored in their eyes. Eyes. The stars are the teeth in the mouth of a shark, but their eyes. Teeth. Eyes. Anyway, you're feeling pretty good about your performance, and it's probably time to go make sure that you know your scenes, know your dialogue cold.
Okay.
So just at that moment, you hear a voice quite familiar to all of you, thundering up from the dressing rooms, saying, "Why are there so few buckets down here? If I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times, that scene has to be positively dripping with blood. And I need an actual member of the clergy or it won't be funny." This, of course, is Truxton Spendlove, the director.
This is going to be a problem. I'm not going to be able to stop laughing at the names long enough to actually participate.
Oh, don't worry. You call him Truck. He insists. Yeah.
That's better.
I head over to the nearest intercom or whatever equivalent system there might be. And the other half of them are upstairs. It's fine. And I think that we got one of the understudies, Jansen Benoit, ordained.
Ordained. Ordained. Swear it to me, Lazenby. Ordained, you say, or I'll have your head.
He's a Unitarian. But it'll have to do.
Just snorting in the background when I hear the word Unitarian.
Well, he'll have to do.
To no one in particular, I'm just going to ask, is blood, real blood? Is there normally a lot of blood in music?
Well, for this kind of show, yeah, it's normal.
Right.
We actually have a little bit less than some shows call for, but it's because we have the talent to make up in style.
Well, as long as it wasn't too expensive, I suppose, and avant-garde, right? Prestige. I start backing away into the backstage.
Impossibly, Truck is suddenly standing behind you in the flesh. Nothing cheaper than blood, don't worry, he says.
I nod very seriously. Good.
I give Truck a knowing look.
You wouldn't want it said that you were involved in a bloodless production, would you?
Well, no, of course not. And I mean, it's only blood. How much could it cost, really?
Truck nods as though, like, not only is this correct, but you get it. You're in on it now.
I puff up visibly.
You'll be a theater producer yet. He goes upstairs. I need buckets! Buckets!
Mutter under my breath, thespians.
It's a high effort lot, but you learn how to manage us.
I nod decisively, looking very serious.
So if we're happy with the choreo for the first time in an age, then that would actually mean that Jimothy's big scene is next.
Okay.
Are we ready to move on, Eugene?
I think the choreography is sufficient and everyone is properly incentivized to get it right.
I make my way down into the seats and take one in the center, trying to look very knowledgeable.
The showgirls, some of their heels literally smoking, make their way off stage. A few are carried by a few of the others. They are, of course, of a uniform height, so this produces mathematically interesting compositions. Ideas for future runes and sigils occur.
Should they be necessary, which hopefully...
God willing and the creek, well, someone willing and the creek don't rise.
Just so.
So, Jimothy, this is your big scene. This is the scene where you deliver a monologue to the young ingenue played by the up and coming Noella Ainslie, to whom you are declaring your love and to whom the stars themselves are promised. As an encroaching darkness takes on the world, it's really a classic love story. And you have been prepping for this. You have practiced this in a mirror, let's say. In fact, this was what you were practicing downstairs. It strikes you perhaps as an unusual protestation of love, but that's the theater. Yeah. One must expand one's horizons.
I open the libretto for probably the first time since I selected the play to produce and start looking at the scene, muttering to myself, says he's willing to do a lot of violence for her. Shrug it off.
You think you hear the libretto echo violence, but that makes no sense, so you shrug it off.
Someone's just practicing somewhere, it's fine.
The libretto shuts of its own accord.
Magnets, I think.
All right. So I'm going to say, actually, Eugene, could you please roll for me? Which am I going to have you roll? I think actually this is meat and potatoes. What's being tested here is not your razzle dazzle. It's your patience. You have been at this for quite a long time. So let's see if you can hold your grace as we move on to the next scene.
And how many dice am I rolling? I assume it is at least two.
Yeah, that's a good question. Let's see. I'm going to put it up to you whether you feel like you have help or whether you're alone in the world. But you are doing something risky, which is moving on with this play and believing that the dance number will be fine. So that's one D6. Your role is relevant, so that's two D6. Remind me of your want.
the accomplishment of the ritual encoded in the play.
So that's definitely 3d6. I'm going to, I mean, yeah, it's up to you whether you feel that you have help.
No, there's no help here.
3d6 it is.
And I'm looking for ones or twos.
You are.
Two ones and a six.
Well done. Well done. So you succeed. And I'm sorry, your mark is two. So you succeed, which is to say that things go well as far as the scene change. The band is struck up. The string player is replaced in due order.
We have a set of them for in reserve.
As one ought. Particularly
it's one of the expenses that has been creatively overlooked.
The new one takes his seat next to the concertmaster, looking very harried and nervous, but also very dapper in his tails. I think he'll do well. He begins to tune up tunelessly. Meanwhile, Jimothy takes the stage. This is your big moment. You would think that this previous moment was your big moment, but the moments seem to keep getting bigger. Still no sign, by the way, of your recently tentacle-faced mentor, but hey. You know, that's showbiz. He'll be here because he actually has to arrive at the end of the scene to announce the coming of the darkness and the ending of, you know, everything else. Mm-hmm. So, okay. Razzle dazzle roll for me. How does your monologue go?
Let's find out. So, how many dice would you consider that I have?
It's a very good question. So this is risky. Everything you do on the stage is risky.
Yep.
Your role is relevant, so that's for sure two. This engages your want, so that's three. Do you
there
have
has
help?
Been help. There may not presently be help, but there has been help.
That's true. How do you feel about your scene partner?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think, you know, if you'll permit some imagination, I suspect that she is quite a competent actress, but is at a disadvantage because she doesn't know why we're here. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there is some angst that creeps into her performance where it's not meant to be, due to the puzzling and disjointed sometimes, dialogue that is present.
She has commented before that this is an unusual love story, and the director, I believe, has chimed in and said that love itself is unusual. The only thing you'll never find is usual love. That seemed to satisfy her, but you're right. She doesn't get it. She thinks you're just here to do theater, not to change the very fabric of reality. Mm. Although, if you tried to explain the difference to her, she might not fully acknowledge it.
Mm. Okay, so...
So do you have help, I guess, is the question.
Yeah.
That's the mechanical reason that your feelings toward her matter. Do you feel that she has your back?
I think that she does, because she wants the play to succeed. And so when she sees me floundering, she will do her best to match that energy and pull it back into something that makes sense.
A beautiful thing, that. 4d6, then.
Okay, and this is Razzle Dazzle, or?
This is Razzle Dazzle. You're looking for greater than or equal to your mark. Yeah, three's
not. Okay, so my mark is three. I have but a single success, a three.
A single success. So you squeak by with a complication or cost, is what that means in mechanical terms. Mm-hmm. You begin to give the monologue. Could I have a little bit, I forget what you were saying in front of the mirror. Could I hear that again?
Yes, well, what is the character's name that I'm speaking to, unless you would like me to make something up?
No. The character's name is B.D. Finlinson.
Okay.
You call her B, of course, term of endearment.
Mm-hmm. And lo, B, gaze upon the stars as they gaze upon us. Know that up there is a black hole where our souls should be. Taken from their three dimensions down into two, but as we lose dimensionality, we blend one into another, as love should be.
She goes up. She does not remember her line. She stares at you. Her eyes actually seem emptier than eyes should be able to be. No color, just black. That can't be right. You must just be scared.
Jimothy continues with her line because he's memorized them. Oh, what is my character's name? That's a good question.
That is an extremely good question. The answer to that question is Jansen. Oh, no, we already used that one.
Yeah, I vote Ute Lund.
Ute Lund. Yes, you're sure. We're going to use one of the ones that sounds absolutely filthy. Your character's name is Ute Lund.
Okay. Yes, indeed. What you say is true. You are now speaking to me, saying that, yes, Ute Lund, you know, as we are losing dimensionality, we gain an infinite, nigh overwhelming, beyond the realm of sanity, oof. And here, Jimothy forgets her line at the end and is starting to just vamp, and it's not going well.
Truck appears, a bucket in each of his hands, actually two buckets in one hand, overflowing, spilling on the carpet, a beleaguered front of house manager trying his best to catch and clean it up behind him. What was that, kid? You call that a ritual? You couldn't summon a dog catcher with that.
I'm flipping through the program looking for the actor's name who's playing the dog catcher. Not seeing it.
I thought, and perhaps I was mistaken, but I thought you wanted this job.
Sorry, sir. It won't happen again, sir. I was just, you know, I was thinking about my character's motivation, and I want there to be something, but also there's nothing. I feel as though my character wants fame and success and, you know, to be a big star, metaphorically and perhaps literally, but a star is destruction. Its very light is consumption. The unmaking of one thing and the making of many more. And I got lost in the metaphor. I'm sorry.
Kid, you got a square jaw and a high tenor, but you don't make a lick of sense. He drops the buckets. They are caught, mostly, and he storms off with no further comment. Eugene, reactions to this fiasco?
I will take the young actress aside and try to coach her back into a semblance of humanity, even though I know for certain that she is now a host, as is proper and intended for the, she will become the vessel.
Indeed. She is speaking. It's not English. It's a language familiar, unfamiliar, impossible, and unspeakable. A human tongue should not be able to make such sounds, so hers must not be the part of her that's making it. Her eyes are still completely black, although not perfectly black, not a velvety black, the swirling black of the cosmos if you could see an infinite distance. It's going well.
Yeah, no, you're doing great, sweetheart. But if... You could hold off on the change until, like, the actual end of the play tonight. Then that would have the maximum effect. We timed it. It's down to, you've got about a 5-minute window for everything to be aligned correctly. So, English until then, please.
She says, "Short, Mr. Blasen Beep."
I appreciate the effort.
At that precise moment, Pendrum Bringhurst reappears and says, "But nothing will come of nothing, and all shall come to nothing." He has covered up his tentacles with thick pancake makeup, so his face is the color of human flesh, but not remotely the shape.
I give a polite little clap to his introduction.
He pretends not to notice it, but gives you a glance of appreciation. McCord, how's this going in your estimation?
I am very worried, but I have been reassured that everything is fine. This is all normal, so I'm trying very hard not to appear bothered, but I am definitely pestering Truck and pretty much any other person that I can speak to who I don't think is totally beneath me about just making sure, you know, that this is definitely going to make a big splash and everybody is going to think it's very fancy and artistic.
You know. It will make a splash.
Truck has grabbed the seat on the aisle and he reacts to Big Splash. After all, he has about four buckets stacked, which is what he's propped his feet on.
I'm now imagining how improbably long his legs must be.
Right.
You ever seen that caricature of William Gilbert of Gilbert and Sullivan, where his legs are like twice the length of his torso? That's
no, right. But I can imagine it.
Yeah,
it's a leggy gentleman. He says, "Oh, first opening night. Of course, of course, of course. You're nervous. It's completely normal to be nervous. But this is going to be a show not soon forgotten. By the way, the blood budget has tripled. Wouldn't worry about it."
What? You know, I was thinking about it. Don't butchers just give away cow's blood for free? Why are we paying?
Sure, they give away cow's blood.
So the thing about the tripling of the blood budget is that it's still within your overall budget.
Well, that's certainly good to hear. I know that, you know, this is only opening night, and I want to make sure that the show has the money that it needs. And of course, money is no object.
If everything goes off well tonight, then you will have nothing to worry about.
Well, I do trust that it will go well then tonight, and I'll be right here in, and I gesture to the VIP box. I'll be right up there with the VIPs. I'll be bringing them in, glad-handing, making sure they know that what they're about to see is the future of musical theater. So, I'll do my part. I trust all of you will do yours.
Oh, indeed. I will make sure of it.
I'm hoping. I'll have a lot of requests to meet you after the show. The creatives behind everything and the lead actors, you know, gesturing at where I think the actors probably are. Have we... This is a silly question, I know, but... I'm new to the theater. Have we also budgeted for the cleanup? This much blood is, well...
Oh, yeah, no, it's in the contracts, don't worry.
Excellent. I figured you were on top of it. Well, I'll leave you to it and just observe unobtrusively. I stand 3 feet away and scrutinize everything.
Got one more task for you, Court, if you don't mind. A member of the some church or other is very concerned about the production. If you wouldn't mind just assuring him that we are a perfectly respectable operation. The Reverend Vard Hatch, would you mind speaking to my financier? He disappears before you can say anything else.
I take a stealing breath against my frustration and turn to face the clergyman.
The clergyman is shaped like a fire hydrant, short and wide. He has no jawline to speak of. His expression is as though he's persistently smelling something not especially pleasant. He's got a priest's collar. His eyes seem to be pinched closed. You're not sure if in disapproval or sleepiness.
I guess I didn't get any information about the denomination this fellow represents.
Colors suggest Catholic, but not or Episcopal. Sure, so Catholic light.
Right.
He'd love it if you said that.
Yeah. I'm sure, yeah. So I'm going to...
I will remind you, we're in Boston. Right. Catholic is a reasonable guess.
That's true. So yeah, I'm going to give him the once over. Remind me of his name.
You ask the hard questions. His name is Vard Hatch.
Yeah.
Vard Hatch.
What a name.
Father Hatch. Nice to make your acquaintance. I incline my head rather than offer a hand to shake because I'm too important for that.
He looks oddly approving of this, by the way. Game recognizing game.
How may I reassure you about our little show?
An associate, it seems to me, has brought to my attention that your production is unacceptable. It seems to contain no less than 43 blasphemies, 23 apostasies. There seems to be a scene involving a recently ordained seminarian, and it's scratched out here, no longer 3, 6 gallons of blood. Are you worshipping the beast in this house of ill repute?
Father, I can assure you that no worshipping, much less of beasts, is going on in the theater. That is, for houses of worship. And if it is any consolation to you, I'm informed that the clergyman in the scene you refer to is a Unitarian. I regard him as though this settles matters entirely.
His face transitions through not thinking that counts to thinking that might be good to disapproving again. Could you for me? Let's see. Is this Razzle Dazzle or is this Meat and Potatoes? This is right on the line, isn't it?
I know which one I want it to be.
Yeah, sure. You know what? Yeah, call it Meat and Potatoes.
All right. So, my mark is 5, so I have to roll 5 or less.
Yeah, let's call it 3d6.
Okay.
Cause you don't have help. You have definitely been left twisting on the line, right. But the rest of the rules apply.
Okay. Yeah. So let me roll that, and I've got, 1, a 2, and a 6. So that's gonna be 2. I nailed it.
All right. Unitarian, you say. So not really a man of the cloth at all. That does change things somewhat, but would you mind terribly if I stayed and watched this rehearsal? Dress, do you call it?
Indeed not, Father. You're welcome to stay in the seats here. I'd appreciate it if you didn't interfere with the temperamental theater artists. You know how they are. I give him a knowing look, but I think
he jolts away when you give him the look as though you're about to bite him.
I give him another appraising set of glances and say they are a strange breed, but quite good at what they do, and I think you maybe will come to an appreciation of their craft, if not a love for the theater. I think you'll see that what they do is, well, nothing quite so spiritual or supernatural as you seem to think. It's merely their craft. It's what they make. It's their skill they apply. Like yours at oratory and moral reasoning, and mine at finance and investment.
If I may be quite honest, I prefer oratory and moral reasoning, and I prefer finance, if I'm forced, over all of this spectacle. But the rabble will have their spectacle, and so it is up to us, as men of the world, to shepherd them to a wholesome spectacle. So, as best we can, let us do so. He settles in. He extracts a small vial from his jacket and clutches it. It might be holy water.
I give him my most affable nod, which probably is not in the absolute all that affable, and then with my hands clasped in the small of my back, I stride about as though I am making a difference here. I most certainly am not.
He sits, he watches what's happening on stage, which is another run through of your big scene, Jimothy. This time your scene partner manages to say the lines. It sounds as though she's saying them backwards. Not that she's saying the words in a backwards order, but as though, some sort of radio program is being played incorrectly. It's a strange experience, but on the other hand, she really seems to be feeling it. You can really feel the love. You can really feel the devotion to the end of things as they are known or could be known. You feel good.
All right.
She, when it's over, kisses you on the cheek, which was not scripted, and says, "Thank you for helping me through this strange experience."
In response, so Jimothy is oriented to what might be going on. So in response, he just gives a bit of a comforting buzz as though with flies.
She smiles. It's sort of a wan ingenue smile, but it quickly becomes toothy. Are her teeth sharper? She leaves the stage. So this brings us to the 11 o'clock number. The chorus girls come back. The chorus boys come back. It's time to rehearse the last sequence heading into the big finale. And good thing, too, because the house is going to open in less than an hour. You're really down to the wire here. But hey, that's showbiz. There are buckets piled in the aisles. Stagehands are starting to cart them off to the wings and up above the stage, of course, which is very important. This is the number, the slapstick number, the French Follies number, as well as the big dance number, wherein our newly ordained Episcopal preacher will be drenched in blood. The drains in the stage open with a loud clang. Some of the players who are in splash range, the harpist and a few others, put on raincoats. We're ready to begin running the number.
I am, at this point, catching my breath, leaning against a post backstage and mopping my brow with a handkerchief. Less sure than I've ever been, but trying to project confidence and knowledge in everything that's going on, as though I knew anything about it. I have asked for a poncho myself.
You've received one from a stagehand who you know pretty well. This is Jaxton Young. He used to be a newspaper man. He's from somewhere else in the state. Good fellow. You're pretty sure when his coat slipped one time you saw gills, but you know, it takes all kinds. Anyway, he hands you a poncho. The mops have already been prepared. We have to run this thing with all of the effects, but then we've got to get things ready for the audience. So that's the showbiz.
I'm trying to imagine cleaning up 6 gallons of blood in like 10 minutes.
The wonders of modern soap.
In a world that has not invented vacuums yet. Right. Mm.
If only there was something that would just slurp up all this blood.
If only.
I've often thought that myself, so often. If I had a nickel, I tell you. He's carrying yet more buckets. You really don't know. Like, that's way more than 6 gallons that he personally has taken. But, you know, he's the boss to some degree. Eugene, how do you feel about this number? Has this one been going well?
This one, I think, has been going well. I think mostly it's the wrangling of the chorus girls that's been a problem. Hopefully this is solvable. But I don't know. I suspect that there's a Catholic in the house. That may make life more interesting, but the First Amendment's on my side.
It's true. That's definitely true. He would argue that, or rather he would think he wouldn't have to, but you know. So the chorus boys have come out in their coats of impossible geometry. Looking at them for more than a few seconds hurts, as it should. The chorus girls are dressed as nuns, as is correct. The priest does not like this one bit. He looks around as though for a life rafter, as though he's caught someone doing something. We'll find out in a second if you go to help him. Our dear financier. But everyone's ready for the number. Our couple is center stage. You can sort of see that Noelia has the change coming on, but she's fighting it off like a champ. She's a definite pro. And we're ready to begin. The band is striking up.
To be very clear, I don't actually care whether the ritual goes off in the dress or in the opening, just so long as it does. But the timing is mathematically, I think, better for the opening. But almost may be good enough here.
Well, we may find out whether it's good enough. And in fact, to that end, if you could, roll meat and potatoes.
A 1, 4, and a 2. Do get one question of the world.
You do. What would you like that question to be? You also succeed, by the way. That's relevant.
But yeah, that's also relevant. Yeah. But I assume that this wasn't withheld, but that everything else was relevant.
Yeah, that was, if you would ask, that's exactly what I would have said.
Cool. How can I ensure that the father plays a part of his own?
That's a very good question.
A late addition to the cast, as it were.
Well, I suppose when he sees what's about to happen here, you could convince him that only he can stop a blasphemy and get him to try to physically intervene, and then maybe showtime's a little earlier than expected. The press is already arriving.
I am already in the sort of vicinity of where they enter, trying very unsubtly to sort of prime and coach them in ways that they probably do not particularly enjoy or appreciate. But I suppose if somebody were to draw my attention to our priest, I would attempt to explain away the presence of the nuns in a way that would keep him from flipping his lid.
Oh no, I'm counting on you being distracted by the press.
Well, those are the conditions, I suppose. It's up to Drew.
Fair enough. No, let's say you are currently talking to the press, and it's up to you whether you're able to extricate yourself, or indeed whether you even know to, right? You've never seen the nun number with costumes. You've been real behind. You've seen girls around dressed as nuns, but I mean, it's the theater.
Yeah, what I was going to say, unless somebody draws my attention to like, oh, we've got a priest problem, I probably am just doing my best to glad hand the press and probably landing somewhere on like a, you know, tepid enthusiasm handing instead.
A newspaper man whose eyes are a little too far to the sides of his head than you would usually expect is saying, so is this an operetta or?
It's a little more of a comic opera with some vaudeville in it. There's a sous-sant tension between the more serious themes and some of the more lowbrow presentation that's supposed to evoke the differences in the worlds the two central characters come from and how they can create a new one for themselves. You can quote me on that in the paper.
You see him writing down burlesque at that exact moment.
I start to say something, but
at that exact moment, truck comes by and says, "We've got a priest problem."
Meanwhile,
well, you'll have to excuse me then. I will be happy to speak more with you, but and I hurry with dignity toward Father. Oh, I forgot his name. Dang it!
Oh boy, we're really bringing hard and fast with the face names. Father Hatch.
Hatch.
Vard is his first name. You would never call him Vard.
No, certainly not.
Oh, I call him Vard.
I would never call him Bard. Father Hatch, I am hurrying to where I assume he's turning purple.
Well, perhaps we may slide back in time a bit so that I can determine the degree to which he has turned purple and possibly is up on
this
the
stage.
This
would be contemporaneous, contemporaneous with McCord working the press. Yeah, that's just fine.
Yeah.
At the sight of the nuns, he looks around in a look that transcends time and space. The fuck are you seeing this sort of look to no one in particular and everyone at once.
And I am at his side. And isn't it marvelous how it undermines the authority of this other church? I figured that you would appreciate it.
Which church are these supposed to? Are they Episcopal?
Yes.
We certainly had Unitarian before, and the idea of Unitarian nuns is very funny to me.
We've specified that the priest is Unitarian.
That's true.
Fair enough. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just thought it was funny to drop the idea of Unitarian nuns.
No, Unitarian nuns?
Unitarian nuns is an objectively funny concept. But I didn't think that the good father would buy it.
Fair enough.
I think I don't think this is responsible. You and I, men of the world, we understand, but the common man will think that you are mocking.
I can see your point there. And if you'd like, I could arrange for an explanatory presence if you wanted to be such. On perhaps stage at the time.
Perhaps I could give some context. I won't sermonize too much, but if I could morally direct... Oh, but I'm no... What did you say? Thespian? He says it as though he thinks perhaps it's a sexual orientation.
There is only so far distance between the style of oratory that your own good self offers your parishioners and the sort of role that is necessary for the explanatory presence that I think we are both imagining in common here for the context necessary of the number.
So this is certainly something you're trying to do with cleverness, trickery.
Oh, of course.
One might say razzle dazzle. And so would you mind rolling 3d6?
Adam?
Mm-hmm.
Would you be so good as to increment the counter?
Holy shit, really?
On this most specifically auspicious of rolls for that?
Incredible. Couldn't have asked for better. Happy Halloween.
For reference, dear listeners, I rolled 3 sixes.
Well, I suppose I could prepare a few remarks. I think for the moral instruction of these wayward theater goers. You can already see his wheels turning. He walks up onto the stage unbidden. He's trying to stay out of the way, but he's also scribbling furiously in a little notebook. He pats Jimothy on the shoulder as he walks by.
I mentioned that the green tape on the stage that's in a pentagon is probably where he should stand.
Pentagon?
Mm-hmm.
Or
Pentagon.
Okay. He scrutinizes it, but then he stands on it. He actually puts down a small cloth and stands on that on top of it.
That's cute.
So Father Hatch is standing impossibly, almost in third position, to put both of his feet on this little hanky that he's put down. It's not really big enough for that. It's not like an altar cloth or anything, which is good because it might be a flame if it were. But he is standing there. He's scribbling wildly in his notebook. Every so often, he invokes the heavens for inspiration. He seems to receive it because he keeps writing. It's time to run this number, I think.
I take the Unitarian aside and tell him to all is well, just let Father Hatch have this one.
His eyes well with tears.
I let him know that this is just the dress and this is mostly to appease the good father so that we can actually have a proper opening.
He says, You would know, Mr. Lazenby, but I'm ready.
I'm ready. Thrilled. Your willingness to work with the cause is an inspiration.
He walks off stage, tugging at his collar, which he has, which is weird because he's a Unitarian.
Also, I love how my character is speaking on two levels at basically everyone.
It's like how, you know, like Popeye has like two tones. It's like Tuvan throat singing. it's like that. All right. So Jimothy, you are center stage, you and your leading lady. And this is the moment where you kick it off. You begin this number with just a bell tone from the orchestra. And as the maestro raises his baton and that bell tone rings out, you prepare to sing. Could you roll Razzle Dazzle for me?
I would love to.
With 4d6, because you are very, very helped. This is very much in line with your goal.
Okay. So my mark again is 3.
Mm-hmm.
I've got two threes and two fours.
So four successes and two questions that you can ask the universe.
That's correct.
Yeah. So four successes, right? With
spectacular.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. You're off the charts successful, and you get a couple of questions.
Okay. Let's see. Gosh, just when you're given $1 billion, right, you don't know what to spend it on.
I was going to say, in character, I think the question that McCord would want you to ask is, what is McCord trying to tell me with his eyes and eyebrows right now from where he is looking very concerned at Father Hatch on stage? But probably that is not a priority for Jimothy, if I had to guess.
Let's see. Okay, so here's a good Cthulhu mythos type question. What exactly are we summoning? And how do I quiet that nagging voice in the back of my head saying that this is a bad idea?
Your question. So the answers would be something from beyond the stars, indifferent to human life in the way that human life is indifferent to that which it cannot perceive. And booze. Those are your two answers.
Okay.
But you did say, what exactly are we summoning? So you actually gain sort of a vision. You see in your mind's eye a vision of your mentor's face changed with tentacles, but you experience that as sort of a Fibonacci sequence. The tentacles are infinite, fractal. If you zoom in, there's another face equally tentacular. And if you zoom in on that, another and another. If you zoom out, there's an infinity of them. And if you continue to zoom out, you exit the eye of a single human being who is not tentacular yet. And if you continue to zoom out, you see the entire universe. And then in a moment, you zoom back in and see nothing. That's precisely what you're summoning.
Okay. All right.
For a second, when you mentioned the infinitude of tentacularity, and the just after the Fibonacciing of them, I was imagining like the most appalling version of a broccoli head.
Oh God, I'm appalled.
Yeah.
So there is everyone's mental image for this.
Ew.
You're welcome.
Eloquent as ever.
So a voice from beyond the stars blesses and curses you with images of bodies that could not, should not be, that are incompatible with life as you understand it, and that same voice tells you you probably want to get a drink before the show.
Okay, so I'm not yet on stage, or I am?
You are on stage, but the show has not started, right? We're still in the dress.
Yeah, so we're in the extremely late-timed rehearsal that is perhaps right on time for what we need it to accomplish.
Non-press is now gathering outside. The truck is outside glad handing the crowd, trying to buy you a little bit of time. It is now up to you whether the plan is to rehearse this or not. But if you want to make sure everything goes well, do you really want to do opening night without a dress? That's up to you.
I think we proceed with the purpose, if not with the play. We've got a slight departure from the casting, given that the father has taken the Unitarian's place. But I think that is an opportunity. So the stars should be as right as they will be.
Very well. The stars of stage and screen, that is. Well, what's the plan then? Do we go ahead with the rehearsal, or do we let in the crowd and take the whole show from the top?
I am currently panicking a little bit that we're not already letting people in. whether this makes
a difference
to the cultists or not.
I would be happy for people to be let in for the completion of the dress ritual.
An invited dress. Okay, sure.
if you could pitch me on this as a good thing for reviews and ticket sales, I will escort them to their seats myself.
Eugene, roll Razzle Dazzle for me.
Beautiful. Yeah, I so 4, 4, 5. That is three successes again. And the rationale that I am offering you is that is twofold. One, we want to assure everyone that we do indeed have the willing support of the Boston Archdiocese, as well as give them a teaser, a word that has not been invented yet, of the delights that they will see when the time comes for the actual opening of the show.
I steeple my hands. Yes, Archie. Well, I suppose if I can select VIPs, members of the press, couch it as the approval of the Archdiocese and a little amuse-bouche for what the show has in store. 15 minutes?
I think we can delay that long.
I clap my hands in my white gloves with a muted thunk and go about selecting people to be let in, laying it on very, very thick. As to how special and rarefied this opportunity is, and you know how Father Hatch, you know, has agreed to you know, sort of add some verve to our dress rehearsal before the show opens. And I imagine I need to roll here, but I don't know.
Oh, you
if
do.
I'm doing razzle dazzle or meat and potatoes.
It's a good question. I think you are attempting style, grace, and cleverness, so call it razzle dazzle.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. I don't love that for you either, but here we are. You do, however, have help, so 4d6.
Okay. Well, that does improve.
And the reason,
my
by the way, that you have help is because Truck is directly behind you, giving you a yes and to all of your glad handing.
That is probably the most I have ever appreciated. Another human being who is not also wearing a tuxedo. Okay, so this is about as good as it could be, honestly, having to roll high. I got a 5 and 2 6s, which gives me 1 equal to and 2 greater than. So
nice.
Gives me a little extra. Well. Yeah, the other one was a 4. So not helpful, but a little extra. And I get to ask a question.
You do.
So my question is, I've been hearing these voices and sort of getting suggestions of the Eldritch. How pervasive have those become at this point?
Near constant. It's actually sort of, you know, if you stay in a place near a waterfall after a day or so, you kind of stop hearing the waterfall. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like that. Or, you know, traffic near you or something like that. Mm-hmm. When you stop and listen for it, there's a sort of a tinnitus of high voices and a sort of low hum of low voices echoing in the music of the spheres in a sort of an imperfect harmony, muttering, chattering. Some of the voices are the voice of the libretto. Others are voices you couldn't identify. One is your own voice.
So I think then that my success is in working my response to this and my not entirely successful efforts to separate reality from whatever's going on into my pitch, you know, as I'm bringing people in and trying to.
You succeed wildly. Not only do they know they not think anything is wrong, they think you're an impresario. Several of them actually comment, it seems like he's hearing the music of the spheres.
I give them my best enigmatic yet feral smile, because any smile I give at this point is feral at some degree. and I seat the highest of VIPs, you know, in the boxes, and I bring in the press and kind of prime them. And if anything, what's reading to them as, you know, sort of bombastic energy is beginning to sort of attenuate upwards into kind of mania as I finish bringing people in.
While that is going on, my goal is to time Father Vard's moral instruction so that it finishes about the same time as everyone is seated, and then we can get on with the show.
Very good. People actually begin to think that it's a vaudeville because there seems to be an act happening before it's begun. There do seem to be beautiful costumed people just sort of standing by, but there's also a priest talking, saying, "Well, it's very important." I believe he does not speak very loudly, but somehow people can hear him. He says it's quite important that you understand that this is not a reflection or a critique of Her Most Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church, but rather of various pretenders. He's going on and on in this fashion, and no one appears to be listening, but he is speaking, and he may not notice, but what is under his cloth has begun to glow just a bit.
And hopefully by this point, the dancers are getting their number mathematically correct.
They are. The Jacob's Ladder is beginning to descend from the flies. It is not yet slick with blood, but the sluices are prepared to receive it. The dancers are beginning. The band has struck up. Things are starting. It has begun to go into motion. Jimothy, would you mind rolling Razzle Dazzle? Because this, after all, is one of your, this is another big moment for you. Sure. Things have gone great so far. Your first couple of notes ring out perfectly, but this is going to be challenging. And it occurs to you suddenly that you were advised to drink and you cannot.
Yes.
I have spent this time moving to the box overlooking the stage, the presidential box, if you will.
Several people point to you. You actually, among the most eye of the peas, you recognize Mr. and Mrs. Karan Magleby, and the Mrs. points directly over your shoulder. When you look, you notice that the libretto is floating there.
I give her an enigmatic smile and pluck it from the air as casually as I can, fully dissociating at this point.
It does not resist you, but it does laugh. Jimothy.
Yes. So, this is my role. Do I have help? And what was the other one?
Does it engage your want? It definitely engages your want. Yeah. This is sort of one of the more important moments. I would say you have help. Your leading lady has taken your hand and she seems to have more fingers than you remember, but... It's the theater.
Oh no, she's AI generated.
I mean, there's some similarities there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like an a non-human creature's interpretation in the amalgamation of what this probably should look like.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, rolling four. My mark is 3. I've got a 5, 5, 2 and a 1. So that is, I believe, just 2 successes.
Yes. I mean, you nail it. Nothing extra occurs, but you, your voice rings out. The crowd, which had been milling and muttering, falls silent. Those who haven't taken their seats, take them hurriedly so as not to miss another moment. The band is perfect. The chorus is perfect. Strangely, you're suddenly not performing the number you meant to be performing, but the opening number. The entire show seems to be happening at once, time compressing, and the priest still talking over it, louder than a human voice should be, but also inaudible, but also inhuman. Words ring out and fly over, perhaps become visible in a strange way, and then the priest begins to levitate. Each number in the show is on top of every other number in the show, and the priest is in the precise mathematical center of the field of view past the proscenium. He does not seem to notice that this is happening. He's still spieling.
I am quivering with glee. It's going right.
Just
the stars are right. The stage is right. The priest apparently is right. The script is right. The dancing. They're following the angles for as long as angles still exist.
I am searching above the stage for the buckets.
They are legion. So time is not progressing steadily. It's not as though every moment is happening equally. The numbers have different weight. It seems as though the more they delight the audience, the more time they're able to take up. But time itself seems to be unraveling a bit. As you look out into the crowd, you see people's ages, their apparent ages, changing. You see babies where babies were not admitted. You see people older than people could possibly be. You see people in dress from completely different times. You see everything. And then the buckets tip. Blood rains down, but remarkably, as it sluices down the Jacob's ladder, all of it pools around the feet of the priest, and all of it curls up around him and forms an enormous bubble. Somehow you can see him through it, even with the sanguine opacity. You can hear him gurgle as it goes around him. It is blood. This is happening.
The chrysalis is forming.
It should be noted that a certain distinguished older actor, the last of the Bringhurst dynasty, is now more tentacle than face. He's disappeared and applied yet more pancake makeup, but it looks as though...
So he's trying to be cauliflower.
That's the attempt. His face looks a bit like if you put a white person's base makeup on a starfish. He's wearing a cravat.
Like
he still
one
looks
of the,
very
the spiny ones that have way too many legs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the legs are quivering. And a few droplets of blood drift away from the priest and tickle the ends of those legs. And they change color ever so slightly and delight. The ceiling of the theater seems to be gone. Stars. The stars are the teeth in the mouth of a shark, but they are also eyes. So many eyes, more eyes than should be visible from Boston, with electric lights coming on.
I find myself reaching up to try and pluck one of the stars from where it is above me.
I'm going to have you roll meat and potatoes.
So I'm thinking that probably this is just one die, but I also am doing it without really having decided to. So, you know, I think that makes sense.
Fair enough. Actually, no, two because you have help. Roll another one because the libretto. Well, you'll see.
I got a one and a four, both of which are less than my mark of five. So two successes. I nailed it.
You nail it. You do have help because you hear a voice clearer than the others, actually clear as a bell, and in perfect English. The libretto says, "Their eyes!" You reach up, you pluck a star, and unthinking, you place it in the libretto's mouth, which it now has. It chews the star with a sound like glass being crushed, and its eyes, which it also now has, six or seven of them, begin to glow.
At about this time, I sotto voce make an offering of the play, the priest, the people, the city, the stars. Commemorated in the math of this production.
It is at this point, Jimothy, that your leading lady turns to you. Makes deep eye contact. This is the point in the number. The numbers? Your big love song and the 11 o'clock number and the big closer and the opening number and songs you learned in school that there's no way she knows as well. You're singing all of them at once, but in harmony. 77-part harmony. Harmony that contains more notes than any human system has yet devised, played all simultaneously in perfect consort. She looks you deep in the eyes, but her eyes are gone.
I find comfort in this. Amidst amidst everything going on at all times, I seek comfort in the void that is this vessel in front of me. And I think I do not find it. But it is a contrast.
Boston is a land of contrasts.
You have the American history, you have the contemporary businesses, and you have the Eldritch horrors from beyond the stars. Contrasts.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you have the Eldritch horrors from beyond the stars, and you have really bad stuff like the priest in the bubble. Right, so right. Your leading lady is before you, but suddenly she is as legion as a blood bucket stacked within the flies of a vaudeville house. There is an infinity of her. Kaleidoscopic, you would almost say, but they're all solid. More of them than could possibly fill the stage. Some are reaching into the blood bubble. Some are grabbing you, your arms, your legs. Eugene, you might notice that they bear sigils on their arms, suddenly glowing, and these sigils are not the ones that you placed. They're the mysterious ones that appeared on the stage earlier. They're sigils from another cult entirely. Suddenly, there are hundreds, thousands of thousands, trillions of trillions of her. It's impossible. The sigils choke out the sight. They're not interrupting the ritual, but they're changing it. They're also changing the choreography.
I give in to the reality of the theater and change the offering accordingly.
Could you please roll? Which do you roll?
I would argue, since I am working on the fly and using words and, you know, fast talk functionally, but the religious version. For Razzle Dazzle, I would probably say that it is with help relative to my role, dicey, but not relative to my want, arguably. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, mm-hmm. it's a different one. Like, I'm still getting the end I want, just not who I want for the ending.
Yeah, I accept this. Cool.
So that is a one and a pair of two. So that is two questions for the universe and a success.
I imagine you might have a few.
Is there any way to get both of these rituals to go off correctly simultaneously?
There is a way, but you would need a lot more priests.
Well,
luckily we are in Boston.
We are in Boston, and we do have the Unitarian who may be fractally multiple now. So, what is that way?
That would be the second question.
Yes.
The way, and you're going to love this, is to really nail that closing number. But here's what you as a choreographer need to do. You need to tell all of them on the fly just what needs to happen. You have to choreograph in a non-linear fashion. You have to choreograph in a way that is untethered from time and space. You have to choreograph in a way that is beyond human ken.
I get cracking. Two of me go out into Boston and start collecting priests. One of me is backstage getting the Unitarian. Four of me are on stage, but like one's in the orchestra pit and two are on the wings and one's like standing just behind the Green Pentagon. And I start directing the choreography.
You gather the priests. You change the choreo. There's six of you with a bowler hat and a cigarette out of one end of your mouth like Bob Fosse, etc.
And white gloves for jazz hands. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's showtime, folks.
So from my over the stage box, I'm seeing as much of this as is evident to me. The libretto has anatomical features that it did not have before and has spoken to me. And so I take this in for a moment and I turn to the libretto and softly, with a voice full of hope, I ask it,
Is this... Will I be... famous?
You will not. Be. But... you will be famous.
I think I take a long count of three to process this, and then just start smiling.
Out of how many mouths?
Who knows? I take the libretto gently in my hands and sort of, kind of pull it to me and begin to exit the building carrying it as though it was my precious child.
It introduces itself as the Necronomibretto, and it accepts the cradle.
Does it start eating him?
It nibbles.
Okay, just the taste?
Yeah. I wouldn't say he's being eaten, but, you know. All good things in time. No one stops you. Some reporters do snap pictures. Flashbulbs go off. Notes are taken.
I'm giving them beatific smiles.
If there are gossip columns tomorrow, you'll be all over them. So, Jimothy, we haven't gotten your reaction to your leading lady multiplying and also bearing the sigils of a competing power. What do you do?
That will not do. I mean, Jimothy has to choose his patron and stick with him. You know, he's not going to rise and sink by his lonesome. You know, he's got to, does this Eldritch horror appear? Is there any indication that this Eldritch horror is more powerful than the one that I'm currently serving?
You don't know whether Eldritch Horrors are ranked in terms of power by sheer size. Mm-hmm. But if they are, you have a problem. You see the faceless face that you've come to adore. A mouth, vertical, and row on row of teeth. And behind it, you see something much larger and much harder to describe, like a gaseous cloud with fingernails.
You may also... see a multiplicity of me organizing the choreo around you as it happens.
You do. And the two horrors may be dancing.
I am counting in four different time signatures out of five of me, and like a sixth one is literally moving people's feet.
Mm-hmm. Every choreographer's dream.
Even Dortha's feet are in the correct place.
I'm going to take inspiration from my choreographer. And so in this moment, I recognize I have some small glimpse of the smallness of my part of this infinite cosmos. So like an ant trying to swing an election. I do my best to incorporate a bit of I'm improvising a contrapuntal tap dance to try to incorporate the energies and just kind of keep things going, or possibly try to short circuit the electronics by, you know, chewing through the wires of the universe. I'm just trying to incorporate the new energy, and yes, and it. So, all right, I see that there's a new mouth opening in my co-star, and that, you know, there is this vaporous cloud of horror that has neither shape nor form, and yet encompasses all. And I'll just try to yes and that through interpretive dance.
Please.
That's my attempt.
Please roll Razzle Dazzle with four dice, because Eugene... I'm going to guess, has never been more proud.
Oh, absolutely. You're killing it, kid.
I dropped one of them. There we go. Okay, so trying to roll high, and I've got a mark of three. I have three successes, a five, a four, and a three. So
you get a little extra layer of reality, a little extra cosmic horror, a little extra end to all things.
Okay.
You're sure now that the two abominations are dancing, and you, and you, and you, and your leading lady, and your leading lady, and your leading lady are also dancing. And she says, Not in words, but you know somehow that she's saying it. I didn't think it could be like this. I thought we'd have to choose.
And isn't that beautiful? The realm of dreams being both that of nightmare and of love.
In your mind's eye, and perhaps in reality, you are Fred and Ginger. She's in a long gown, but the gown is blood. You're in a tuxedo, but the tuxedo is bone. And you dance in the cosmos, dripping with ichor, and clean as the void of space all at once. You do the dance, and she does it backwards in heels.
And inside out.
And inside out. It is horrible. It is beautiful.
And it is so pleased.
It is the greatest opening night in the history of this theater, and it is the last opening night in the history of this theater. Eugene, do one more thing for me. Roll me one more razzle dazzle. Four dice.
Sure. Two sixes and a pair of twos.
Okay. That's interesting. Correct me if I'm wrong. Two is your mark, yeah?
Two is my mark.
You get two questions, and these may be the last questions you ever ask.
They may be the last questions that anyone ever asks.
They may be the last questions.
Did I do it right?
Yes.
Are you pleased?
I don't understand the question. At that moment, nothing is. The blood bubble bursts, pieces of priest with it everywhere, and engulf the theater. You are swimming in priest. And then there is no priest. This expands, because you rolled quite well to the entire city of Boston, and then to the entire Northeast, and then to the entire United States, and then to the entire North American continent, and beyond. Way beyond.
Into the entire.
To the entire. Everything that you've known and everything that you've never known will now never be known, for it is something else, or perhaps nothing at all. You put on a hell of a show. And that's where we'll end our session.
All right. This was incredible.
This is our second one shot that ended with the end of all things. Very different in tone. Thank you very much for listening to Dice Punks. If you want to find more of us, you can do that at dicepunks.com or all over the wide podcastosphere. We also have a website at dicepunks.com. If you want to hear the after show where we talk about what the hell we just did, this should be an interesting one. You can get the Dice Peaks by signing up for our Patreon at patreon.com/dicepunks. That I think wraps up everything. Say goodbye, players.
Thank you for joining us for this weird little adventure. And I guess just always make sure you have more blood than you think you need, because it turns out you're gonna need all of it.
Thanks for listening, folks. And make sure that you get everyone's footwork correct. It's important.
Well, what can I say except thanks for unbeing with us? This has been great. And then it wasn't at all.
Right.
Not great, just not.
And as the poet said, flesh is weaker than the metal, it is true, but the metal's being moved into a thing it doesn't do. Circuitry is only serviceable in as much as it is used, so why don't you use it till you use it up, abuse it. It is strong, it can take it. If you can't, your sinews are more intuitively designed for dance.
Thank you for tuning into this one-shot, dear listeners. Stick around through the admin stuff for a critic review from Drew. The songs in this episode, Theme of the Dice Punks and its acoustic version, were written and recorded by Drew, our generous GM himself. Cover art and editing were done by Joanne, who's appeared on the podcast now and again. Check out her work around the internet, where she goes by Anything Sews. Site design and graphics for dicepunks.com are by Robin, who unfortunately was not in this episode with us. No No Nyarlathotep is designed by John Parrish and was inspired by John Harper's Lasers and Feelings. Thanks so much for listening. You liked what you heard? That's reward enough on its own, but if you're so inclined, you can help us out by rating and reviewing us wherever you listen to us, telling your friends who you think would like us to give us a listen, and even by heading over to our Patreon at patreon.com/dicepunks. We have fun rewards available to backers, including a patron-only Discord and access to the Dice Peaks after show for episodes 1 and following. Regardless, we hope you'll tune in again, and until then, remember, subtlety is for cowards.
Folks, your intrepid critic at large is happy to report that this time something real special has arrived in the Athens of America, as Boston Town's own B.F. Keith Theater welcomes The King in Yellow, the latest and I dare say greatest from the prolific and press-shy team-up of Spendlove and Lazenby. Here working for the very first time with rookie Butter and Egg Man, McCord Sudweeks, who may well have scored his first hit and, if the rumors are to be believed, met the love of his life all in one fell swoop. And speaking of love, the plot for these newfangled book musicals do insist on having plots. Well, this here plot concerns two all-American kids looking for their place in the world. And if they're real lucky, a revelation on the insignificance of place and world alike in the great, grand cosmic scheme. Yes, folks, The King in Yellow is the real deal. A real enough deal to redefine real. Genuine newcomer Jimothy Splanket, who's got a tenor like a church bell and a smile like a high beam, plays opposite the lovely Miss Noella Ainslie, who dazzled last season in Happy End and has only come to dazzle doubly since. Rounding out the cast, of thousands it must be said, is venerable vaudevillian veteran Pedram Bringhurst as the effervescent Miss Ainslie's dear old dad. And my friends, that man has aged like a fine if highly illegal fortified wine. I couldn't help but be reminded of my own father back home in Innsmouth. Funny thing, but more and more as the show went on. But ain't that just the power of the theater? Now, the way I'm going on, you might think that what we've got on offer here is a maudlin or a high-minded affair. But friends, let me set your minds at ease. This is entertainment, first and last. The laughs come quick, at least if you aren't an Episcopal, and your intrepid reporter found the tunes toe-tapping. That is, once he looked down and saw that he'd acquired a few new toes. There's a lot of hot air these days about how a good show can change you, but that's rarely, if ever, been so true as in the case of The King in Yellow. I count myself lucky to have seen it before it was too late.